Breakfast with Rick Goddard.
I just saw a comment about this from Robin Moore, researcher in the School of Social Sciences at UTAS. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Rick.
Who's working with inspirational sociologist Meredith Nash from the Institute for the Study of Social Change. Hi, Meredith. And looking at women of colour in STEM and the obstacles that face them. And I'm interested, maybe Robin, start with you, about how you got into this.
Well, initially, Meredith and I did some research on women in STEM and leadership for women in STEM. And we followed a particular cohort of women. But they ended up all being white women. So this is really problematic. There's a long history of feminism basically representing white women and assuming that the master oppression, if you like, for all women is gender. And while that might be true for a lot of white women, it's not necessarily true for women of colour. So women of colour, they face really different situations to white women, where, you know, race comes into it a lot. So we were a little worried that our research was only representing the voice of white women, and we wanted to expand the research to make sure that the whole conversation around women in STEM wasn't limited to the views of white women.
Isn't that interesting, Meredith? Like, unconscious bias just operates everywhere, and you go, well, women's experience is this, but you've then just taken yourself as a template.
Absolutely. And I think that, I mean, we found in our previous studies that white women were very aware of gender inequality, but they weren't aware of other types of inequality. And so that's really problematic, because everybody needs to be on board when it comes to changing structures and organizations to make it possible for everyone to succeed.
And I talked to Ruby Hamad just a wee while ago about white women, white tears, brown scars, and women of colour's experience of dealing with white women in the workplace and going, ladies, you're just, hang on a second. And like people with power being challenged, the response is, what? No, me, no, never. And then you cry.
Yeah, well, and particularly when it comes to whiteness, white people tend not to see that as a privilege, and to not see it as a racial identity. And this is, in particular, that's what Ruby Hamad is talking about. It's very confronting for white people to be called out for racism, because they don't necessarily see themselves as being in a position of power.
So what did you find, and what was your methodology? Who did you talk to, Robin?
So we talked to about 30 different women from around Australia who work in government, academia and industry in STEM organisations. They were at a range of career points, so from PhD candidates right through to professors. Sorry, my phone just did something weird there. And so I guess what we found really was there were other... We were using what we call an intersectional lens, which is not just looking at one factor like gender, it's adding race, but we found there were other factors that were really having an impact. So things like colourism. So depending on how sort of brown, if you like, or dark women were, made a difference. How Australian women were. So if women of colour were raised in Australia and understood Australian norms and Australian jokes and all those things, they could succeed more than women who have arrived here later in life, perhaps have a stronger accent, something like that. And we also found that seniority makes quite a big difference, because women of colour are far more prevalent at the lower levels of, you know, industry, academia and government. But as you start really climbing that hierarchy, and I think that's what Ruby Hamad is talking about as well, definitely when you get into those more senior positions, then it becomes more difficult. So there's a whole range of factors, actually, that are at play. And so they all need to be looked at, not just gender, not just race, but all these different factors.
It's 19 to 7. You're listening to Robin Moore, researcher in the School of Social Sciences, who, working with Meredith Nash, sociologist at the Institute for the Study of Social Change, has looked at the experience of women in colour in science, technology, engineering and mathematics. Now, Meredith, I spoke to a guy from Egypt. He went to school here. He's studying medicine. I said, what's it like? He said, look, 20 are from interstate, 20 are from overseas, international students. It's a melting pot. We're all equal. It's so fun. And I've spoken to lots of women who are like, yeah, that's what my PhD was like, and the women were better than the guys and stuff. But then what happens over a career? What do you see?
Well, basically, you might see lots of diversity early on in what we call the STEM pipeline, which is this visual metaphor for thinking about how people move through the system into
leadership?
Given
it's a STEM pipeline, presumably it's extremely well thought through, well engineered and laid out correctly, as opposed to the arts pipeline, which is a freaking mess. Anyway, carry on.
Well, and the problem is that there may be a diversity at the start of a science career, but if you, as you move through the science pipeline, people start to leak out of the pipeline for various reasons. And particularly, we know that women leak out of the pipeline for gender bias and all the things we know about, but women of color particularly are what we would call doubly oppressed because they face racism and sexism in the workplace. Mm. And for example, we know that new research from the U.S. shows that women of color working in physics face the most hostile working environment of any group. So the experience is totally different when students actually enter an organization and start working.
And I mean, I have a friend who noted that your chances of getting funding were really massively improved if you were called Dave. There was a list, I think, of 10 different funding things she found. There was every single guy was called Dave. Like, it was quite amazing. And I think in UTAS, in terms of a business that's inviting international students to come, it's a false promise then if the career structures are so broken. So is there any sense, Robin, from the people you spoke to, of what helped?
Yes. So women spoke about mentors. So it's quite interesting because Meredith and my focus is on structural change, but even within a structure that's definitely imperfect, having a good mentor made a significant difference to women's experience. So when you have someone who can let other people know about your research and tap you on the shoulder for things and send you off and connect you with other people, this made a really significant difference. A lot of women talked about that. Also, just having networks among other women, so knowing that your experience isn't because of you, it's because of a system, and it's something that a lot of women in that situation are experiencing. So understanding that you're not alone and having those connections and that support, that made a really significant difference to women.
What's your take on that, Meredith?
Yeah, I mean, I think that when the structures can't change, we can't keep going back to blame the women, and that there are some things that help that women can do to navigate bias. But still, when it comes down to it, at the end of the day, organizations have to be ready to fundamentally change their policies, to close the gender pay gap, to recognize, for example, racism as an important source of bias in a workplace, and not just leave it to women to sort of throw themselves against a brick wall when it comes to trying to eliminate bias by themselves, because that's not their job. The organization is there to support them.
Do you think, I mean, our concept of leadership is that our leaders and the people who head things up should be able to give all of the whole of everything of the whole of their lives, which then means usually someone else is managing the rest of their lives to make that possible. It's subsidized really in the background. Do we need to change that idea of leadership to go, look, a great leader can be there 3 days a week, they have a balanced life and other priorities, and we can still reward them really highly for that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think what Robin and I have found over many years now is that leadership comes in many forms and that diversity is really important when it comes to leadership. And if leadership can happen from someone working three times, you know, working 3 days a week or having a bunch of kids or creating a new sort of way of working, then that's what we should be. We should be putting all of our energy into supporting new and creative forms of leading. You don't need to be in a corner office for 80 hours a week in order to be seen as a good leader.
And Robin, what's your take on that? Because, you know, early on, you kind of don't get anywhere in most fields unless you give the whole of all of yourself to it.
Yeah, I think that's a huge problem. And these norms that exist, they aren't really spoken, but they're just understood. And one of the things that was coming across in the interviews with the women that I was speaking to was how they're quite consciously managing themselves to fit into these norms. So this idea of think manager, think male, and all those sorts of things, but also Australian norms and the rest of it. So
what does it mean in that to perform whiteness? Because this idea will be completely foreign to the bulk of my audience here.
Yeah. Oh, that's a big question, Rick.
We've got 2 minutes.
No, you've thrown me. You've totally thrown me. I guess they're trying to understand Australian humour. Some of them talk about that, trying to consciously manage Australian humour. They do things like, oh, I start conversations about the football. And referring back to your earlier question about the whole idea of leadership having to be in an office for 80 hours a week, some of the women said, I never talk about my children. Like, and I put my children in childcare, which is open for longer hours, so that if I have to stay late, I don't have to say, oh, I have to go and pick up my kids. So there's this whole idea of hiding and managing this aspect of your life and all the emotional labour that goes with that, so that you can be seen as this unencumbered labourer.
It's like mums living in the closet.
Absolutely.
Or parents as well, dads as well.
Yeah.
And it's exhausting that, you know.
That's it. There is a whole lot of emotional labour where these women are managing their whole environment, being wanting to create change, being having to be very careful and very thoughtful about how they present that, because they don't want to be seen as the angry black woman, you know. So having to manage that environment and taking all that emotional labour on top of everything else they're doing.
And I suppose that's something we take for granted in terms of even just sexuality, Meredith, of going like, oh, I can talk about my partner or my girlfriend or my wife casually, but if a woman says, yes, well, my girlfriend, this, blah, 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 presumably there's a moment of silence, there's a beat.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, sexuality is another dimension where it's still not possible to be completely open and free in the workplace. And, you know, turning up to a workplace event and having to feel uncomfortable bringing
with your partner,
bringing your partner.
Yeah.
You know, still something that happens in 2019. And if you're a woman of color and you identify as a lesbian, for example, then it's sort of like you're dealing with a triple oppression.
And we're in a community where, to be honest, I've been at barbecues where, just as someone who worked in theatre, no one knew what to say to me and they stared at the ground. So it's quite extreme.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really strong, this is unacknowledged, invisible labor that women of color and or people with from other marginalized groups are dealing with.
So if you're someone who heads up an organization, what are the sorts of things, Robin and Meredith, you can think about saying or doing in the workplace to at least let everyone be acknowledged?
I mean, I think step one is that organizations actually ask people from marginalized groups what they think and what their experience is. I mean, it seems really simple, but actually it doesn't happen that HR departments are still making policies without engaging with communities in the way that they need to. And I think that's step one.
And listen to it.
Absolutely. Listen to what people say.
Because we've had, you know, we get asked these questions all the time and then nothing happens. And that's disillusioning as well. Robin, what do you think?
Yeah, so there's things like a lot of the women talked about this, a lot of decisions get made at drinks functions after work or something like that. So, you know, the Friday afternoon drinks. Well, if you're from a particular culture where maybe you don't drink alcohol, or maybe family is really prioritised and you want to go home, then those you're excluded from those sort of functions. So this is certainly not necessarily intentional, and the women that I was speaking to didn't think it was intentional, but it still has an effect where they're not necessarily included in those events, so that they're left out of those conversations. They're left out of that decision making, and they don't feel a part of the organisation. So it's understanding a lot of those processes that go on that aren't necessarily conscious, and they aren't part of the explicit process for promotion, but still have quite a powerful impact.
So much to think about. Robin Moore, researcher, Meredith Nash, sociologist. Great to talk to you both this morning.
Thanks, Rick.
Thanks, Rick.